Hello there everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the MEL 2.0 series of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association's podcast. On this final episode of the MEL 2.0 series, we have Double the MEL. My name is Melinda Fernando, and I'll be your host for today's episode with special guest Dr. Melissa Naidu. Melissa is a medical executive with over 15 years of experience in clinical and medical leadership roles across both the private and public sector. She is also a strong advocate for women and diversity in medicine, as well as the importance of self-care in the field of medicine. Melissa was generous enough to sit down with me for an interview about her experiences and challenges in medicine, as well as about her advocacy work in the healthcare sector and beyond. There were definitely moments that were unexpected hidden gems and tangents that I think are going to be really interesting for everyone and make this a particularly insightful conversation for me. I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we reside here in what is now known as Australia, the place of recording. I extend my respects to elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. 'Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
So without further ado, welcome, Melissa.
Thanks very much, Melinda, and thanks to yourself and AMSA for the invitation to be part of this podcast series. I'm a bit disappointed that we can't be in person at the convention because it's been a little while since I've been to one of those.
It's all a bit unfortunate that we couldn't see you in person, but I'm glad we can at least hear your very insightful responses through this podcast series. So to begin, can you tell us three things about yourself that most of us listeners may not be aware of?
Sure. Since you read out my bio there, I'll try and be a little bit more interesting. three things. I'm a serial book club starter.
Love that.
I have a rescue greyhound. Actually, this is she's quite new. She's the second one that we've had. Unfortunately, our first greyhound died while we were in lockdown. We've just fostered a second one and we've not done very well at the fostering because we've already asked if we can keep her. Probably the third thing is I'm secretly an introvert.
Okay, I can definitely relate with a few of those things. And I do know several friends of mine who have also fostered a few like kittens and pets more recently to keep ourselves busy during lockdown.
I think there's been a fair bit of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I can definitely relate to secretly being an introvert. I feel like the career in medicine brings a little bit of the extroverted sides out of us, but I am also secretly an introvert and I do enjoy my alone silent time as well. So we all have our own reasons for our descent into the madness that is a career in medicine. What was your particular journey into medicine like?
So I started out, after finishing school, I went and I did a Bachelor of Science and did a year in perinatal medicine actually. Wow. At the Royal Brisbane Women's Hospital doing some research. So I did an honours year. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing that, I really decided that I loved the interaction with the patients. Mm-hmm. And particularly the babies. I'd always probably had a bit of a leaning. So
yeah.
I was tossing up between doing a PhD, which mm-hmm. my supervisor at the time really wanted me to do, or going into yeah. medicine. And I thought I'd go into medicine. Yeah. I probably had a little bit of a leaning because I do have a fair few doctors in my family. Mm-hmm. That's what propelled me into medicine and down my journey of sort of where I thought I was going to end up, which was pediatrics,
yeah.
but didn't quite end up there.
Yeah. So since deciding medicine was the career for you, how has your life evolved?
I think it's really evolved, and I think I've had to take it a little bit a day at a time or a year at a time. There's mm-hmm. been lots of things I think that, you know, we'll discuss probably throughout today that have influenced the decisions that I've made yeah. in my career. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I'd probably say that since entering medicine, I guess I've had a lot of opportunities, and taking those opportunities have sort of really led me down the path
yeah.
Of being, you know, a clinician and then a medical administrator mm-hmm. And now into a really new role again with the health funds.
Okay. So, as you said earlier, you were particularly interested in training to be a pediatrician earlier. So, what led you to decide to go into medical administration now, and now to be involved with the other side of like public health and health funds, as you said?
Yeah, I think it was more serendipitous than planned, really. Okay. I've always sort of been the type of person to get involved in things to try and make them better. Yeah. From the time I was in medical school and I was on the Medical School Education Committee to the Junior Doctors Society and to the AMA as a doctor in training as well. So I was in pediatric training and I was given an opportunity to take on a medical administration role. Mm-hmm. I think at the time it was probably more of, I saw it a bit of as a gap year for me. I had a few things going on in my family and a bit of family illness and other things that, you know, I had a responsibility for. And so I sort of thought I'll go and do medical administration for a year and then, you know, come back to pediatrics.
Yeah.
So I hadn't really intended it for it to be a long-term option. And sometimes I'm still a little bit surprised that I'm here, but I think I ended up sticking with it because I love the variety of work really. And if I reflect back now onto the things that I enjoyed all throughout, you know, university and my junior doctor years, it was sort of systems problems and trying to improve things. So I think, you know, the variety and the opportunity to do that in medical administration is great. There's never a dull moment. There's often a novel problem to solve that I haven't dealt with before. But it's also opened up a lot of different opportunities and roles for me that I had never really perceived when I first got into medicine. I think that's one of the really great things about a career in medicine. I think there is something in there for everyone, and there's the opportunity for your career to take lots of twists and turns as your interests evolve over time as well.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. Within my span of medical school as well, I've had many twists and turns regarding what I want to do in the future, and it just seems to change every other week, to be honest. So I can totally appreciate the versatility and the opportunities that arise.
And I think that's great, right? Medicine attracts people who've got broad interests and, you know, intelligent people who've got the capacity to do lots of different things. So I think it's natural for you to want to explore different things throughout your career.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned you worked with looking at the different problems and issues that are there and then trying to figure out ways to deal with that from an administrative point of view. Can you tell us an example of one such problem that you've faced and perhaps something that you've done to try and improve that?
Yeah, look, I think there's been lots of them. There's, you know, lots of inefficiencies, I guess, in the systems and, you know, and particularly in the health system, and probably relates a little bit more to my work previously in the hospital sector.
Okay.
But, you know, we know that things don't always go to plan for patients and, you know, there are adverse impacts that we see. Mm-hmm. So I guess I've been involved in a range of sort of system improvements around ensuring that patients get the right care and that when that care doesn't occur in that way, that we can actually respond to it in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, things from that to new innovations, looking at, you know, one of the things I did in one of the hospitals that I was at was around how we support patients with cancer.
Okay.
And the packs that we give to them. So starting up new services, ensuring that we're actually responding to what patients need.
Yeah.
But also dealing with the concerns that arise and that we see come about from system breakdowns or fragmentation in the system. So I can't put my finger on, you know, one single thing at the moment, but there's certainly been a lot.
Yep, of course. I can imagine. And I do think it's quite good that you get to experience, like during medical school, the gaps that are present, and then in the future you can work towards improving these. So the future of clinicians and the patients don't have to be hindered by the same processes and issues that were prevalent when you were studying or working.
Yeah. And I think, look, I think medical students and junior doctors, really are an insight into those sort of things. Yeah. I remember one of the things that I did do as part of my roles is a transition from the old children's hospital in Queensland and Brisbane to the new children's hospital. And, you know, that was a pretty novel thing at the time. There's been a few new hospitals open up since then, but we had a lot of learnings. And really what we saw through the eyes of the junior doctors, who are absolutely the glue in the system, was where those systems and processes weren't kind of designed or geared up for the change. And so that helped us to really identify really quickly. And so one of the big things we did in that was to try and empower the junior doctors to identify problems or gaps and areas of fragmentation and come up with solutions and advocate for those solutions as we work through that as well. So I think that's a really good point that you bring up there, because I think sometimes as you get a bit further away from that, you don't necessarily see where the problems are and what is needed to fix them.
Yeah, and often that just may be because you don't quite have the time to do it anymore, whereas as a student, you spend a lot of your time privy to a lot of, like, that might be going on in the background. So I definitely do appreciate the opportunity to also, like, reflect on our experiences and, like, what we can see, and then hopefully contribute to the betterment of healthcare in general. So I'm glad that you have helped implementing opportunities for medical students to contribute to that. So that's awesome.
That's right.
This is a particularly difficult time for many of us.
That's right.
How have you been coping with the restrictions thus far? How has it impacted your work and practice?
Look, I'm based in Queensland, so we've done pretty well, I guess. And, obviously subject to a lockdown, I really feel for everyone in Victoria at the moment, and particularly Melbourne with the lockdowns and sort of being back there again. And I know we were just discussing that before we came online. But I think it's been a really interesting experience, and I'm trying to find a bit of time to sort of reflect on all of that, because I think that, you know, this has been such a novel situation in that it's impacted everyone in some way, and not just in one, you know, city or town or state or country, but, you know, globally. And that sort of experience across the world is also having an impact. So I think for me particularly, I was actually just 3 weeks into my current role as a group chief medical officer with NIB Health Funds when the cases really started rising. I was commuting between Brisbane and Sydney, and I was really still starting, you know, trying to get my head around this new role that I was in and a new industry. So I've always worked sort of in the healthcare sector, and particularly over the last 10 or more years in hospital management. So moving into a health fund, which is really more aligned to the industry of, you know, finance and insurance industry, even though we deal with health, was a big change for me. And it was a change I was really looking forward to explore again, as we've sort of just touched on before, about curiosity and maintaining, you know, interest in learning new things. That was something I was really, really excited about. So as I sort of found myself in that role, and then dealing with COVID, the role I was in as well was, it's the first time they've had a chief medical officer. So they haven't had a chief medical officer since being a listed company. So it was not just a new role for me, it was a new role for them. And then we had COVID. So in some ways, that was a little bit of a blessing in disguise, because I have been involved in pandemics and disaster management responses in hospital sector before. So it allowed me a little bit to go into my my comfort mode, I guess, as a CMO in managing that for our organisation, both, you know, locally in Australia, but also extending globally. So that was a bit of a comfort zone for me, which gave me a little bit of breathing room as I tried to get my head around the rest of what was this going to mean for the role and for the organisation. So we were an agile workplace. And so I actually gave advice that we move to remote working, and we did that quite early compared to a lot of other organisations, and we were able to do so quickly, and it was working really well. So it's been exciting to be able to have that sort of influence and but it certainly changed, I think, things for me in that I then ended up remote working from home. So 3 weeks into a new organisation where you don't know anyone and you don't really know how things work in a company, to be then remote working in a really different way is challenging. Yeah. But it's, we've learned a lot through that, and we're actually not planning to return to work in the same way that we had before, and really talking about the future of work design, which I think is a really exciting place to be, because those sort of models, I hope, if we can lead them, will be things that we can adopt in other areas and I think are important to look at. And we've certainly seen that throughout the pandemic, I think, you know, for health with things like telehealth and the adoption of that, which opens up a lot of opportunities for access improvement for people.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think also through this role as well, I've also been able to influence support for mental health and wellbeing initiatives, and also a number of clinical initiatives which support those impacted, and also our healthcare workforce. So it's been an unusual experience for me, because I kind of think I know what it would have looked like if I was in a hospital, but it's been evolving in a different industry, but looking at how I can use that role to support what's happening on the ground, both in the acute care and primary care sectors as well.
Yeah, and it's evolving very rapidly, as you say, as well.
Well, that's right. I didn't think we'd be back here.
Very much true.
Adapting again.
Yeah, and as a student also on placement, I have noticed, as you said, there are a few things that we can learn from and bring into the future, even beyond this COVID situation, such as telehealth. I have noticed in consulting a few of the patients myself that a few patients are quite grateful that they now no longer have to attend appointments perhaps 20, 30 minutes away and can just await a phone call. So there are a few positives that I think we can bring into the future, and hopefully that will also help improve the future of healthcare.
I agree. And I think, you know, it's really going to accelerate some of those trends and changes and, you know, system improvements that we were just talking to before that I think have been seen as being maybe very hard or a long way away. I think we've seen as a society, but also within health, that we can do these things and we can do them relatively quickly. So I'm really excited about what that can mean for the future of healthcare.
Yeah, exactly. And I think many of our listeners can also appreciate the difficulty you had in starting a new role without knowing people and then having to work from home, as we were discussing earlier prior to the recording. The poor, more junior medical students starting out in first year have already done half a year without knowing their other cohort mates, and must be quite difficult for them.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, you were just sharing with me about being a final year student and the impact on placements. But yes, I've got a colleague of mine who's just started in first year medicine and was super excited to start that and didn't get much of a chance on the ground in campus. But no, very aware of that. And I think, you know, of all the junior doctors starting terms, new terms, I guess, as well, and how they've been thrown into probably a very unusual situation in the hospital sector, but a lot of uncertainty for people as well, particularly at the beginning of the year when we were talking about people in certain specialties having to work in different roles, about medical students. I think we were talking about how they might be able to contribute to the response as well. So there's certainly a lot of uncertainty for a lot of people through this time, and everyone's had to adapt, I guess.
So I'm just going to read out a little tweet that I have saved here. As clinicians, we come from different backgrounds and specialties, but our values are singular. Our commitment is clear, and in this moment, more than ever, our hearts truly do beat as one. So this is a tweet you had sent out during the escalations of the whole COVID-19 situation that was quite insightful. Can you explain why you felt it was important to spread this message of inclusivity, particularly at that time and even more so now?
Oh, look, I think inclusivity is so important. This was actually a quote from a letter that was written by doctors Vivek Murthy and Alice Chen. And it was tweeted at a time when COVID was really escalating. And I think I was really sensitive to the fact that, you know, talking and having conversations with my medical friends and colleagues, like I could sense this feeling of fear.
Yeah.
And concern, but also really conscious of that inner call to duty that I think we've all got to help yep. those out and mm-hmm. to use our skills despite personal risk, and felt a sense of solidarity with that. You know, personally myself, I even remember having conversations with my husband about whether I should volunteer to mm-hmm. go back to front line and to assist as well, because clearly I was in a role that was not, you know, in the hospital sector or front line at that time. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, it caused me to really reflect on what it is inside us
yeah.
that I think creates that sense of wanting to help others and to be present and to contribute what we can.
Exactly.
I think in health sometimes we can tend to be very insular and stick a bit to our own. There's a little bit of medical tribalism that goes on, you yeah. know, between different specialties and different grades, and it's a bit hierarchical.
Yeah.
But I've had the opportunity through my various roles to work in different capacities and to also build networks outside of medicine
mm-hmm.
And health, and it's really taught me so much. And it's also made me realise how important inclusivity is. And it is really the solution, I think, to a lot of the health problems that we've got, or finding the solutions to the health problems that we have.
Yeah.
And I think at times like this, it becomes even more important that we actually work together rather than against each other.
Exactly.
And that's for the benefit of making sure that those people who need access to care mm-hmm. Get it, and that we all make a contribution. You know, I'm reflecting on some of the other comments, I think, in webinars and some of the social media I've seen about, you know, people, vulnerable healthcare workers
yeah.
who aren't able to be on the front line. I'm one of those myself.
Mm-hmm.
I also reflect on, as I just mentioned before, people having to work outside of their roles or
yeah.
their scopes. And I think that, you know, that inclusion about, it's actually about how we all pull together.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a similar reflection is around the whole of system response. So, you know, the importance of primary care, the acute hospital sector, the public sector, the private sector, the health funds of everyone, government,
yeah.
pulling together and working in a systematic way for the one singular goal is really, really important, because if we're all siloed and if we're all just concentrating on ourselves,
yeah.
We're not going to beat this thing
exactly.
or any of the other, you know, chronic problems that we face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if there was ever a time for us to all pull in together and just work together and just appreciate the role that each of us have, no matter where that role may be, whether it's in the front line or just more so in the background, still playing our parts to help everyone through, it is important that we do stick together and we all work together, as you said.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that sense of solidarity mm-hmm. and that, you know, as a whole, we can be so much more powerful than as individuals.
Exactly, yeah. And we all do have a part to play in this. And that's also very important to understand as well.
That's right.
And it goes beyond the medical field as well. I've honestly loved seeing so many people from other fields outside of medicine also just getting involved, doing what they can, be that through volunteering. So it shows that everyone does have a role to play, and this inclusivity comes beyond the medical and healthcare field in general as well.
I think that's actually a really great point. And I'm reminded of one of my my doctors that, you know, does some work for us
mm-hmm.
In emergency assist, had made a comment to me about when I'd asked, you know, is there anything you guys need on the ground?
Yeah.
And he'd made the comment to me, well, we're fine, actually. We've got lots of people who are bringing us, you know, food and
yeah.
looking out for us. It's actually, you know, the teachers or the police people
mm-hmm.
Who might need more support than us as healthcare workers at the moment. And that just, your comments there just reminded me of that, about
yeah.
how it's actually so much broader than just, particularly in this situation of the pandemic, than just about, you know, the healthcare workers, and that even those who are finding themselves in a situation where they're facing, you know, the onslaught of patients in
mm-hmm.
in the hospital sector are thinking about others
yeah.
As well.
Exactly. So moving on, I also understand you are a strong advocate for women in medicine. So can you tell us a bit about what led you down this path in particular and what your involvement has been thus far?
Yeah. So look, earlier in my career, I think this is probably something I've come to a little bit later in my career,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's because early in my career there were certainly a lot more women
yeah.
Alongside me, and I think the playing field was probably a lot more even.
Yeah.
But really possibly because I was fairly oblivious to sort of the barriers and inequity that I think a lot of women face in progressing their careers.
Okay.
As I've moved into more senior roles, those barriers and the biases have probably become a bit more obvious to me. Mm-hmm. And although I think most of it or much of it is unconscious, it's still exclusionary. And I think there are daily microaggressions that can make it harder to get your job done and to do it well.
Yeah.
If I reflect back when I first started in med admin, I didn't have many role models really who looked like me. And I think at that time lacked a bit of confidence as mm-hmm. to whether I could actually be like the leaders that I saw around me at the time.
Yeah.
Because I felt different. You know, I felt like I looked different, I was different, and I led differently. So I'm really grateful to the sponsors that I've had who've grown my confidence, you know, over the years and helped me to lead authentically and find my own style. But I'm very conscious, I guess, that, you know, I think gender balance is something that eludes us still in the workplace structures and systems, and particularly in medicine. Mm-hmm. We know we've got more than 50% of females graduating from medical school, and yet once you get into those leadership roles within medicine, the numbers drop dramatically. Like they actually drop through, you know, specialty consultant level roles mm-hmm. In specialties, and are particularly absent in some particular specialties.
Yeah.
But once you get into leadership roles, the numbers are really quite low. And, you know, that suggests, particularly since we've had those numbers of graduates for a long time now, that it's not just a pipeline issue, that there are other mm-hmm. factors at play. And so I guess having found myself in a leadership role and understanding that, I felt it was really important for me to be able to use my voice and to advocate for mm-hmm. for women in medicine. I think they've got something significant to contribute to it.
Yeah.
And that I guess more than that, you know, wanting to amplify the voices of women who are coming up through the ranks as well, and encourage and be a role model and let them see that this is something that they have something to contribute in, particularly in leadership roles, mm-hmm. but also trying to be an advocate more broadly for diversity and inclusion in everything I do. So it really stems from the fact that I firmly believe that in order to overcome some of those really entrenched health problems that we face, both, you know, systemic problems, but also inequities in health, that we need diverse leadership. And without that diverse leadership, we're not going to understand and overcome the barriers experienced by those people who aren't represented in decision-making and leadership roles. And so, you know, some of my focus has been on women in medicine because there's a very clear line there in terms of understanding that the numbers of people are there, the numbers of women are graduating from medicine, but they're not making it into leadership roles. But there are also a number of other people and groups that are not represented in, mm-hmm. in these decisions. And we can't speak and make policy and changes that reflect those people's needs if we're not representative of them.
Exactly. Yeah, and honestly, coming from another female who's just embarking upon my career in medicine, I am honestly very grateful for the work that men and women such as you have been doing in paving the way for us so that we can also have the opportunities to rise up and also make changes and help pave the way forward for future women and other people in medicine who are less represented, as you said.
That's right. And I think it's at that intersection as well, you know, mm-hmm. particularly we often talk about intersectionality. So it's, you know, if you're a woman and you're a woman of colour, or if you, you know, have a disability and, you know, if you're a disability and of a different racial background, mm-hmm. like all of those add up into disadvantage in terms of being able to progress opportunities and careers. And I think it's something that particularly in health, to be able to understand the needs of various different groups is really important in addressing the health issues and problems that we face.
Yeah.
So it's really, really important that we absolutely encourage mm-hmm. everyone who's got an aspiration to do that, no matter who they are, that it's possible and that they can make a significant contribution, and we allow them to.
Exactly. So I should just read out another quote. "When I was training, she operates like a man was supposed to be a compliment. So post COVID-19, I reckon he leads like a woman should be a compliment too. So this is what you retweeted from Ria Liang, and it was another of your more intriguing tweets. Can you please explain what you meant by this one?
Yeah, I love it, actually. It's such a great quote. I'm a really big fan of Ria's, and I've had the opportunity to work with her. She's fantastic. And yeah. I do often love her tweets. I think I do retweet it quite a bit, actually. but what I really liked about this was it was just a pause for thought, right, about how we view roles and, you know, who should be in them. And it's kind of a bit of a just shining a bit of a spotlight, I think, on that unconscious bias, right, about what we think people are and stereotypes. So we know there's a fair bit of evidence to show that women outperform men in emotional intelligence, which I think we're increasingly realizing is a really important trait of leadership. Men tend to be a bit better when the focus is on managing tasks, and women tend to do a bit better when the focus is on managing people. And, you know, these as well are stereotypes, but I think this quote just sort of showed that, you know, maybe we need to think about that and how we attribute different traits to different people. But I think the quote's less about sort of men and women, as you know, as we've seen through COVID, some of the best examples I think of leadership that have been really hailed have come from women leaders. But it's really more about that focus on leadership through empathy, collaboration, a focus on people and enablement. And that's not to say at all that men can't lead in this way too. And I think that the male leaders that I most admire do lead in that way. And it's also not to say that all women lead in that way, but I think what it highlights is that leadership and modern leadership really requires a different set of skills to what we've probably revered in the past, which has been sort of, you know, control and command and control, sorry, and heroic leadership, but much more of a distributed power base. And I think there is a tendency for women to lead a little bit more in that way. So I do like, I think this is a great reflection on, you know, operations, obviously, about what's seen as very sort of hierarchical and structured as well. So I think it just is a nice contrast between the two and what we need for modern leadership.
Exactly. And, yes, as we can all appreciate, since we've moved away from the more paternalistic approach to medicine that used to exist, and now we're more so about also listening to others and addressing the other aspects of human well-being that we are now aware of, such as the emotional aspect, and addressing and trying to treat and help those aspects as well. So, and I do appreciate that women who are particularly more well-versed in such traits do have a role to play as well, as you have highlighted. So that's lovely.
And I think we're all capable of it as well, but it's nurturing those sides of us, as opposed to, I guess, the sides that, you know, have previously been seen as needed for driving people forward and for achieving and for climbing, I guess, you know, your career ladder. So
exactly.
It's probably focusing on those other aspects.
Yeah, so I do admire your work in helping pave the way forward. I also noticed on the Women in Medicine website that there was supposed to be a symposium this year. Can you give us any updates on that front?
I wish I could. I think, you know, look, I'm really hopeful that we'll have a symposium. I think when I put that last update, things were looking pretty good in Australia, and I was hopeful that maybe towards the end of the year, November, December, we could have another symposium. I think now with the outbreaks in Melbourne, Victoria, and possibly just keeping an eye on what's going to happen elsewhere in Australia. I'm not quite sure about a date for that. I think when I first started the symposium, it was because I felt there was a need. So I'd had the opportunity actually to go over to Harvard and complete the Executive Women in Healthcare program, which was really eye-opening for me. That's several years ago now, and it just made me realise that we weren't having a conversation in medicine about gender differences and barriers or about inequity or really around diversity and inclusion. And so the first symposium I held was about wanting to share that, I guess, with my female colleagues that I'd had a number of conversations with about this, but it was probably becoming more of a topic in other industries, and I had the opportunity to go to events in other industries just because of those sort of cross relationships. And I thought we really need to start thinking about what this means for medicine. So that's how the first symposium came about. And I kind of hadn't intended that it would be ongoing, but clearly there was a bit of a need there. And yeah. So we've tried to evolve it over time. I think the first one was really looking at work-life balance. And last year we looked at amplification, mm-hmm. and that was really amplifying women's voices, but also looking at the impact that women can have in amplifying other voices yep. that aren't heard. And so I think this year I've been toying around in my head with where we take it, what the next step is. And I think there really is something there around true diversity and inclusion, yep. And particularly the learnings out of COVID and how we create opportunity
yep.
to make those who are less visible mm-hmm. More visible. And to support them, I quite enjoy the opportunity to connect and see how the women who come along to the symposium, and I should say men too, because we did have some men attend last symposium, which yeah. I think is really good, because I think they need to be in the room. I think we all need to be in the room having these conversations
so.
About what the future looks like. So I do hope we can host it, but I'm not sure when that might be. But keep an eye on the website.
That's what I was just going to ask. So for our listeners who are very much interested in the things you just mentioned, so what would be the website for them to keep an eye on, if you don't mind just repeating that?
No. Not at all. So it's Women and Medicine and being AND, womenandmedicine.com.au. I was just thinking then, and I should probably think about maybe pivoting and doing something online. I was invited to speak at something earlier this year, which was an entrepreneurs symposium mm-hmm. That was had to quickly turn around and become a virtual summit.
Yeah.
And clearly, AMSA are looking at these podcasts as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the problem for me is this is my little side hustle. So it's about getting a bit of time to be able to think about how I might do that. But mm-hmm. Keep an eye on the website. I have to admit, being distracted by COVID at the moment, I probably haven't updated much there recently.
Yeah.
But you can certainly sign up to follow it. And so when there is an update, then we will. We'll make sure we let you know.
Right. And I'm sure there'll be a lot more coming in that front in the future beyond this all. So hopefully our listeners can get involved in the future. That's awesome.
And now for a quick word from the M20 team.
Hey, everyone. So to commemorate the convention that never was, Mel 2.0 is dropping exclusive merch on Sunday, August 2nd. We have a limited number of patches and t-shirts, so get in quick when sales open. We're also acknowledging AMSA's most seasoned veterans with coveted medals of honour based on the sticker book and eSports Day participation. For more information, head to the AMSA National Convention Facebook page.
So, another subject I would like to get your insight and advice on is something many of us medical students and future medical professionals face and will continue to do so in the future, and that is the difficulty in saying no. So this is regarding understanding the limits and boundaries of our roles and also knowing when we should look after ourselves and instead of just continually piling on jobs and tasks at the sacrifice of our own well-being and our own time. So particularly as a female in some medical spheres, at least personally, I feel like we need to constantly prove ourselves or work even harder than our male colleagues to get noticed and strive for our goals and, as you said, to become leaders in the medical field. Did you also feel this, and how did you combat this as a junior student or junior medical professional?
Absolutely do mm-hmm. feel this, and I don't think it's exclusive just to juniors. Yeah. I think the pressures on you as a junior and the competitiveness can certainly play into that.
Yeah.
But I think I've got it on my Twitter handle that I am a serial overcommitter, in brackets reforming. So yeah. I'm trying not to overcommit myself to things.
Yeah.
Look, it's a difficult one to answer, really. Mm-hmm. Because I think it is important to say no. I'm not particularly good at it, but that's possibly because I feel very passionately about a lot of things, mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in a lot of things. So I tend to probably say yes to a lot of extracurricular things that I've got a real interest or passion for.
Yeah.
But as you sort of said, they kind of pile up and, mm-hmm. and that on top of a very full-on day job, it does make it difficult sometimes to balance it. I know my husband quite often says to me, well, you do this to yourself. and there's probably a little bit of FOMO in there. I don't like to miss out on things. But I think I have learnt over the years about saying no, and particularly saying no to those things where you actually have that feeling like, I don't really want to do this, or I wish I didn't have to, but I feel like I have to say yes.
Yeah.
So in those situations, I've probably gotten a lot better. I've still got a well overcommitted and way too much on my plate, but I have learned to say no to the things that I don't really want to do and that I feel I'm doing really for somebody else, where there is no either benefit for myself or drive from myself to do it.
Yeah.
And I've also realized that saying no in those situations creates a space for you to then say yes to the things that do matter to you.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of reflection on this, I think, that's needed, because you should learn to say no, but you should also not be afraid to say yes.
Yeah.
And that's to say yes to those opportunities that will come your way.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel like you're saying no just because you're worried about being a failure or there's a bit of imposter syndrome, then I think, you know, breathe through that discomfort and don't let fear rob you of opportunities.
Yeah.
Because I think that those opportunities, and sometimes taking those opportunities, running with them and learning how to do it as you do, as you go along are important. But I think it's where you get that feeling that I'm doing this just because, and there's not a real drive for it. Now, I say that because I think it's really hard, particularly for medical students, for junior doctors. I know there is a lot of competitiveness and feeling that you need to keep up with all your peers in order to be seen as, you know, the preferred candidate for a whole bunch of things. And, you know, I just think that sometimes you've got to make a decision about whether that's the right thing for you to do, and that's sometimes a very brave and courageous decision about really focusing on the things that matter and being, you know, the best medical student, the best junior doctor that you can, rather than, you know, I know I often get asked by junior doctors about all these additional courses that they should do or research and to be seen as more attractive. And I kind of think it's about really goal alignment. So, you know, for example, yourself as a medical student, you're obviously involved in, you know, AMSA and supporting, and people get involved in committees. And I think that's really good for self-development and professional development if it's aligned with what you want to do. So I think what I've said there is that, it's hard to say no, right? And there's a lot of reasons for why we do the things that we do. And I do think, yes, for women, we are used to probably taking on a little bit more and multitasking, and this becomes increasingly more difficult as you, you know, you may then down the track also have a family or a carer responsibility in some way, which adds to the mix. I think it's not about keeping up with your peers. It might seem like it's about that, but I think it's about really aligning your goals, saying yes to the things that matter and that will impact, and definitely say no to things that you're just doing for other people, not because you want to do them.
Yeah, very much so. And that was very insightful. Thank you for sharing. And I do believe that there are often certain moments and things that happen in your life that give you perspective and help you like reshuffle your priorities and just figure out where you lie in the sphere of your life, how medicine and your career fits into the balance of things that we have in our lives. And I do believe one of those things is probably also not just being in the medical field as a doctor or a medical professional, but also being as a patient. So personally, myself, I've been in the hospital as a patient, and I do believe that so have you. You conquered breast cancer.
Can
you tell us a bit about this experience and how this impacted your life and mindset?
Yeah, so you've probably uncovered the secret of saying no, because I think this certainly did help and does help now when I get overwhelmed or asked to do things I don't really want to do. Yeah, look, and we will all be patients at some time in our lives, and I think it's really important to remember that. I unfortunately was a patient at a much earlier time in my life than I thought I would be. I'd had pretty good health up until then, and other than having my children, had not really ever had an extended stay in hospital. I've never even broken a bone. So when I was, 37 years old and diagnosed with aggressive breast cancer, it was a complete shock to me. Mm. My two daughters were only 2 and 3 at the time. So, still pretty dependent and needy. And I was just sort of had been appointed to what I thought at the time was, my dream role. And it was my dream role at the time. But, I think I've been lucky to have multiple dream roles over the years. I thought my career, I just kind of finished, got my fellowship, stepped into this role, really thought this is my time. That was just such a sinking feeling for me because I thought I've just done, and everyone in medicine knows this, the amount of years that you've put into getting where you want to go to, feeling like, that had been delayed a little bit by the kids coming along as well. So I kind of felt for the first time like this is my time now. I'm getting to do what I want. I'm in the job I'm in. And then I was hit with this diagnosis, which was, significant at the time. And it was a real moment for me about thinking about what this meant for me. I saw my world come crashing down. I thought my career was going to be over, that I'd worked so hard for all of this that I wasn't going to realize. And now I was a patient. Several years of treatment and therapy, and I'm just this will give away my age now, but 7 years post, so, and cancer free, which I feel very, very fortunate and lucky to be, because I know there are people who've come along on that journey with me, friends from support groups who are not in the same position, and I don't think it's necessarily fair for anything more than luck in some situations. But I think, what I've really taken away from it has been that I've always been a fairly empathetic person. But being a patient myself really helped me to understand what it was like to be in a patient role. I consider myself highly health literate, with arguably a really excellent understanding of, the system, the health system, both private and public, and connections, personal connections to make sure that I had absolutely the best care. And yet I still felt incredibly vulnerable throughout my treatment, and frustrated at times. And I know there were times I didn't speak up for myself when I should have. And I also had things go wrong. I had adverse events and I had complications. And so when I think about that, and I just think, imagine how disempowered your average person who doesn't have any of those things feels as a patient. And I really use that every day now when I'm making decisions that either impact patient care, but also in dealing with and understanding people, because you never really know what people are going through in their lives, but also what makes them vulnerable. And so I take that and I carry that through with me all the time. I think it's really important. I think it's really important to remember that, we all will be patients. People we love will be patients. And for a number of years afterwards, when I had responsibilities for junior doctor workforce, my orientation speech at the beginning of every term or year would be that, just remember, it's easy, I think, to disconnect yourself emotionally and to think about how bad a day you're having because you're overloaded, or which, we know is a problem. But that's not that experience for that person sitting in front of you where this could be a life and death situation, or they don't know if it is. And the impact on them and their family is huge. So I think remaining connected, empathetic, and human is really important. And I think encouraging our students and junior doctors to do that, and to not lose that sensitivity as they progress through their career, and reminding our senior doctors of why it is that passion for medicine, why you got involved in the first place, and not losing sight of that. So I feel incredibly lucky to be alive. My GP saved my life. So I think that's the other thing that I've probably learnt from that is it's important to have a GP. I didn't have a GP, but I had young children who had a GP, which was very fortunate for me because it was someone I trusted immensely. And that was the person I went to who diagnosed me and made sure that I took care of myself. Mm. But I think the other thing is about taking care of your own health and well-being. So, you know, I went not because I suspected I had breast cancer or I had a lump, but I had pain what appeared to me to be an infection. So I went to get antibiotics. That's why I saw my GP. And I think that seeking help, looking after yourself and not ignoring health issues is really, really important. I think we tend to give our own health a bit of a secondary, we place it second place. Mm-hmm. And that is a big taking for me because even after I walked out of the GP room and she said to me, you know, you need to go for a scan, that I was thinking, oh, well, I've got a lot on at work, so I'll go in about 3 weeks when I've got time. Luckily, she made the appointment for me the next day, called me up and didn't give me a choice. But so certainly I think some learnings out of that is make sure that you look after your own health and well-being, because you can't help others if you don't do that. Yeah. Make sure you have a GP and somebody else who is looking out for your health and well-being, because you will be conflicted when you've got other things that are pulling and tugging at you. And always remember the vulnerability that patients feel and that people feel, and look at it from their perspective when you're thinking about how things are for you. And I think make sure that you always stay connected.
Thank you, Melissa, for sharing that very personal story. Sounds like it was quite a harrowing experience for you all, but I'm glad that you recovered through it and you've learned a few things down the track, and it's also influenced the way that you practiced. And I can also appreciate and understand the importance that you emphasize about looking after our own health. I don't know whether we often try to overlook our own health because we learn about the worst that could happen often in medical school, and it might be out of fear or just out of just being too busy. But it is definitely important to seek help for ourselves, have a GP, and just look after our mental health as well. That's still a bit of a taboo field in our medical careers and in medical school as well. But we need to acknowledge that.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much for highlighting that. Also along the lines of, as we were talking about earlier, about the importance of saying no and overcommitting, it's also important to say yes and to take opportunities that arise, because the future is so uncertain, as you have shared.
That's right.
So other things that you want to appreciate and ensure that you do have a balance in life is having interests outside of medicine. And as a mother of two, you probably are quite busy outside of your career with your other hobbies as well. How have you managed to balance your career and your life?
Look, I have to admit, and you've probably picked this up from talking to me already, I have to admit I'm really not the best at this. And I think, you know, my family would certainly think my life is not very balanced at all. Yeah. I think for me, I try to overcome my tendency to perfectionism and to let go of control for the things that I don't really have any control over or don't need to control, and focus on what matters most to me in that moment. So that's really the sort of thoughts I try to have in trying to get balance. But, you know, I quite frequently, and even after having a significant illness, you know, I do fall back into the old habits of, you know, working too many hours or not paying enough attention to my health or well-being or exercising. But I guess I have had the benefit of a significant illness, and that does remind me every now and then when I feel like it's getting out of kilter, it reminds me to stop and reassess. And I think the key here really is that balance is an elusive thing, and I think work-life integration or work-life flow is a much more helpful term, because I think, you know, balance is also just putting another pressure on yourself, I think, to have things that are perfect. So I think what I try to do is encourage people to shift their focus and their energy onto what you need, what you need to at that time, or what's most important to you at that time. And I think the key to it all really is about continual reassessment. You're never going to have it figured out. It's going to change. It's going to, you know, I just think about my daughters, and, you know, there's times when things are really smooth at that, and other times where, you know, it's a bit bumpy, and actually family and home and my kids do need a lot more focus than my career and Or yep. I look at now where we're dealing with the unknown in COVID and in a new role, and I go, well, actually, yeah, all my energy does need to go into that at the moment. But trying to put those sort of supports around you to allow you yep. to put your focus where you need to is what's important. And not everyone has the opportunity to do that. I'm very mm-hmm. lucky. I've got a very supportive husband. My kids are great as well. They're very understanding of what I do for work, and will often say, you know, it's really important, Mommy, that you go to work because you do these things. But I also need to remember that it's really important that I raise two human beings who are going to make a difference in the world in the future as well. I think interests in terms of that, I do love art. You know, my favorite thing to do is to go to the art gallery with my youngest daughter, who's also an art fan, and we do visit regularly. But to this point about balance, you know, we returned to the gallery just recently for the first time after lockdown, and it was an almost overwhelming experience. And it just hit home to me and reminded me how much we take for granted until we can't do it anymore. That's what I would take away thinking about, you know, career life balance. I think it's, mm-hmm. you know, what are the things that if we couldn't do them anymore would really matter to us? And that will change with time. And I think focusing on where you can spend your time and where it matters most to you is the way to achieve that.
Yes, I totally agree. And in this unique environment that we're all experiencing, I do believe that quite a few of us will be self-reflecting and thinking about what we do value, and we'll probably appreciate even just merely going outside for a walk a little bit more than we used to. So
it's
definitely a time to self-evaluate and reflect.
That's right.
Unfortunately, time has been flying away from us, I see.
Yes.
We're almost to the end of our interview. I'm just going to ask a few more questions if you don't mind.
Sure.
Lovely. So what is some advice you wish someone had told you when embarking upon medical school and your career in medicine?
So look, my father was a surgeon, so I think I had a pretty realistic understanding of the demands of a medical career.
Yeah.
I don't think, and you touched on this a little bit before, I don't think I really appreciated the emotional toll it can take over time.
Yeah.
I wasn't really prepared for that. I wish I'd been given advice earlier about looking after, my own health and well-being.
Yeah.
I think that we do that a bit better now mm-hmm. with medical students, junior doctors, those coming through. But I think, you know, the stigma of illness and I think that is physical illness, but also particularly mental illness, as you mentioned, in the profession is still an issue.
Yeah.
I'm on the board for the Doctors Health in Queensland, sorry. It used to be the Queensland Doctors Health Program.
Yeah.
And this is something that we're trying to address, you know, right from early on, right throughout professional stages. But, I wish I'd been told that it's okay to express sort of vulnerability and to reach out for help.
Yeah.
I think I had a great support network around me. Mm-hmm. And when I did have physical illness, I was able to do that. But I also wish I'd been told to run my own race. And I think we touched on this before about competitiveness. I think I was forced to take time out and look back. And looking back, you know, I don't think any of that time that I've taken out either for children or for mm-hmm. my illness or to support my family's illness has impacted my career.
Yeah.
I understand it feels really, really intense when you're in the thick of it mm-hmm. and competing for jobs and opportunities as a junior doctor, worried about the training programs. But it can be hard to maintain perspective. But the advice I give my trainees and mentees now is that, you know, there'll come a time where you look back and you go, actually, that's not what mattered. And so I think, you know, run your own race, do what matters to you, and concentrate on where your values lie and how you kind of live to those values and goals.
Yeah.
That's the advice I wish that I'd had and I try to give now.
I'm sure many of our listeners will take that on board. Thank you very much for sharing that. If your current career wasn't an option, what would you choose instead?
That's a really tough one, actually. I did want to go to art school when I finished high school. I think I'd love to do something creative, probably photography mm-hmm. or design. When I was on maternity leave with my first child, I actually started a photography course because I mistakenly thought that I was going to have all this spare time. Anyone with kids realises that maternity leave is definitely not a break to take up a new hobby. So mm-hmm. I never finished that. But look, having said that, I think I get to express now in my career some of that creativity anyway. And I feel a bit lucky that I've gotten to choose several careers already. You know, I've got to be a clinician in pediatrics. I've been an educator in clinical training roles. I've done hospital management and leadership roles. I've been a board director and, you know, I've been a mother, which is really one of the most challenging jobs I think I've ever had and has taught me a lot about leadership and managing people, actually. But, you know, and now I'm in a different playground in an executive role with a health insurer. So I think, you know, I feel like I've gotten to do a lot of different things and all of them have had different angles and I've tried to bring in what I would have liked to do, which is creativity, into some of those roles as well. So I think that's the great thing about medicine. It does give you that opportunity to explore and create a bit of a niche for yourself that fits. So, yeah, I don't know. I think I'd still choose medicine but yeah, definitely would like to do something arty if I could.
Yeah, I think that was a great response. It's always a good reflection on your life when you could think of no better career choice than the one you've chosen. So I think that's great. And it's always good that you can have these hobbies on the side to further pursue those interests. And the fact that you've been able to integrate a lot of these creative and ingenuitive aspects into your life has also been a terrific progression. So finally, for our very final question, our theme for convention this year is new perspectives. What is your perspective on that theme and how do you believe your work and what you see your work progressing in the future fits into this dominion?
Look, I think this is such a great theme, and I don't know if when you set it for the convention, you knew what was going to happen around COVID. But yeah, it's a great theme, I think. and COVID's brought so many different perspectives, right? We're looking at things really differently. So I think perspective is so important, and life is really all about perspective. I've had, as I mentioned just before, you know, I've had multiple career breaks really on account of, you know, having kids, my illness, and returning to work after each one of those has been really daunting. Like I certainly don't underestimate for people who've been on, you know, parental leave breaks, coming back to work can be really actually quite frightening. But I've had the opportunity through those breaks, through those kind of shifts in attention and shifts in perspective to reassess my goals and directions with each. And I think that's what's been really, really valuable to me. All of those have given me a different perspective. And when you get those opportunities, taking the time to reflect on your journey and what you've achieved is really important. And the chances are that you've learnt far more and done more than you think if you pause and reflect on it. And I think all the things that happen to us in our life, all those life experiences do give you perspective. Reflecting on them allows you to take lessons and learnings from them. And when you do that, you're actually able to translate that into what you do every day. And so I think those experiences have given me a much broader perspective. You know, just age does that sometimes as well. And that really influences the way that I make decisions for myself and in my own life and in my own career. And it's given me, you know, the courage really to be able to make choices that I sometimes think I might not have made had I not, you know, been unwell and faced my own mortality. But I think it's given you courage, but it also gives you courage to be vulnerable about things as well and to share that. And I think it's really important that we do that and allow people to know that sometimes things look really fantastic and all put together from the outside. But you know, my life is certainly not together in any way, and there's you know, a scramble of chaos at home, and sharing that and letting people know that that's okay is an important perspective as well. So I think that's one of the things I actually have thought has been great about COVID is seeing things from other people's perspectives, and we're doing a lot of meetings from Zoom at the moment. And it's just really given an insight into, you see one version of people, and then when you see them in their own home juggling what they need to juggle to continue to work, it does really give you a new perspective. I think we all put these sort of masks on and try to present ourselves in ways that we think we're meant to look like. So I, you know, congratulations to you all on a theme where I think there's so much that you can bring out on that. But I think, embracing new perspectives, reflecting on them and incorporating those learnings into how you live your life and you do your work is really important.
Yeah, those were some very wise words to share. So perhaps if we all take a few minutes at the close of this podcast episode to pause and reflect on ourselves. So thank you very much, Melissa, for joining us today. I'm sure our listeners are feeling particularly inspired by your message and endeavours in life.
Thank you.
And I'm sure many listeners could relate to a lot that what you were saying and were probably nodding along like I have been as you were talking. So thank you very much for sharing everything and all your insights. If anyone has any questions or would like to get involved in your advocacy programs and initiatives, what would be the best way to get in contact?
So I'm on Twitter.
Yeah.
Dr. Mel Naidu is my Twitter handle. You can certainly shoot me something through a message through there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, through the website that I mentioned before, womeninmedicine.com.au, I'm happy to take messages through Facebook on that. There's a Women in Medicine site on Facebook as well, so you can send messages through that or through the website. But yeah, no, very happy to take any questions. And thank you very much for the opportunity to chat today.
Thank you. I found it very inspiring and I love chatting to you. Honestly, time just flew by.
That's right.
So thank you everyone for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampule podcast, Mel 2.0 series.
Whoa, okay, that was spooky. Whatever could that mean? But anyways, thank you for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampule podcast Mel 2.0 series. Our code word for this week is Lap the Map, which if you go to our website www.m2020.com.au and insert the code word in our portal, you go into the running for some great prizes and giveaways, and over the course of our series, we'll be able to collect an image per week for our M20 sticker book. Mel 2.0 is a subset of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association's ongoing podcast series to highlight speakers who would have presented at our 2020 AMSA National Convention. If you'd like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website www.m2020.com.au or our parent website www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we are on social media as the AMSA National Convention on Facebook and Instagram. For more information of topics covered in this podcast, you can reach out to AMSA on Facebook, Instagram, and the AMSA website. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you'd like to know more about our public policies, please visit our website at www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy followed by Official Policy. This episode of AMPUL was hosted and edited by Melinda Fernando, with special guest Dr. Melissa Naidu, and music by James Palmier and credits by Nick Berry. Thank you for listening.